Hi there. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Arthritis Life podcast, where we share arthritis life stories and tips for thriving with autoimmune arthritis. My name is Cheryl Crow, and I am passionate about helping people navigate real life with arthritis beyond joint pain. I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years, and I'm also a mom, occupational therapist, video creator, support group leader, and I created the Room to Thrive self-management program. I am so excited to help you live a more empowered life with arthritis. We're going to cover everything from kitchen life hacks to navigating the healthcare system to coping with friends who just don't get it. Seriously, no topic is going to be off limits on this podcast. My interviewees and I share our honest stories of how chronic illness affects our lives. This includes discussions about mental health, sex, shame, pregnancy, body image, advocacy, self-acceptance, and so much more. You'll hear stories from all ends of the spectrum, from a person who's living in Medicaid remission from psoriatic arthritis to somebody living with severe mobility restrictions and severe pain from rheumatoid arthritis. You'll hear how people manage their conditions in different ways, like medications, mindfulness, movement, social support, work accommodations, and so much more. You'll also hear from rheumatology experts who just get it. We'll dive deep into the science behind chronic pain and what's the latest evidence for lifestyle changes that can help you thrive with arthritis, including exercise, sleep, nutrition, stress reduction, and more. This is your chance to sit down and chat with a friend who's been there. Ready to figure out how to manage your arthritis life? Let's get started. I'm so excited today to have Catherine, also known as Kat, Ames on the Arthritis Life podcast, somebody who I've actually met in real life, which at the rheumatology conference, which is actually most people I talked to on the podcast I've never met. So I'm happy to have you here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Can you just let the audience know a little bit about you? Like, where are you located and what is your relationship to arthritis or chronic illness?
Sure. So I'm a San Diego native, West Coast, Best Coast.
Yay.
I was actually born in Hawaii, military family, and then moved to San Diego when I was like three. So I've always enjoyed nice temperate climate, which when I was diagnosed with multiple overlapping chronic health conditions in 2018, I didn't quite realize how much the weather actually affected my health. So, you know, I would try to travel after I got sick and, you know, learned about how much the climate has an effect on my joints and my skin and all that stuff. So, I'm based in San Diego and pretty lucky to be here. And my main conditions, my relationship with chronic illness, my health collapsed when I was 21 in 2018. Okay. And, I'm one of those question mark patients, you know, is it ankylosing spondylitis? Is it lupus? We kind of don't really know. So we're still, you know, using lupus to get things covered by insurance. But
yeah,
still one of those question mark patients who is just basically throwing spaghetti at a wall to see what sticks.
That's so hard. I often call that diagnostic purgatory, where you're just like, not sure.
Yes.
What you have.
Love that term.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I would love to hear more about your process of getting diagnosed. You know, what were your symptoms, and, you know, in 2018, how did you actually get to your at least preliminary diagnosis of some sort of lupus type thing?
Yeah. So I've always been somebody who has burned the candle at both ends. I was doing theater. I was doing varsity sports. I was doing speech and debate, community service. If there was an after school anything, I was doing it. And I was also a super hardworking student. So anytime I got sick, kind of growing up throughout middle school, high school, even first 2 years of college, it was always like, you just need to slow down. You just need to do less, pick one. And yeah. I've never been a pick one kind of person. I'm like, I can have it all.
Excuse me. So similar. Yeah.
And so anyways, that was all sinus infections, mono, whatever was spreading at whatever school I was at, I got. Yeah. And that evolved into when I went abroad in my semester for my semester to New Zealand, fall of 2018, I got there and I was like, woo, let's party. I'm a single girl. Woohoo. I'm gonna like go out in the town, meet a cute Kiwi. And was having the time of my life and figured these weird symptoms that started to pop up were just like, I was just too hungover too often. You know, stayed out too late dancing in the club. And then they like didn't go away. My knee and joint pain, you know, I thought was from like walking miles around the city, you know, just wild, wildly crazy with my friends until 3 a.m. I was like, oh yeah, it makes sense that my knees are red and swollen the next day, or that I have a migraine that lasts 48 hours, or that my cheeks are super flushed and I have a low grade fever. I'm just sick. You know, I just am like, my body put it through too much last night. So like, as I tried to ease off of that a little bit, because it started to affect my ability to attend class, the symptoms never subsided. And that was raising a lot of alarm bells for me, because it started interfering with my daily life. So I would lie down to go to bed at night, and my heart rate would be through the roof. It was like a horse was galloping on my chest. Like I was running a marathon and lying completely still. And I would take my heart rate and it would be 180, 190, lying still,
oh
trying to sleep.
Yeah.
It was insane. And I started getting nauseous all the time, rapidly losing weight because I started to get not so nauseous. Anyways, long story short, went to the urgent care in New Zealand many a time. And because they have step therapy there, I needed a step 13, which was steroid and an antibiotic. But you have to go back for each step in order to basically get the next step crossed off the list so you can graduate to the next therapy or escalate your care. Quickly realized that was not going to be fast enough care and get me better fast enough to stay for my semester abroad in New Zealand. So came back home early. That was like the saddest 13-hour flight I've ever been on.
So sorry.
And, within a month of getting home, my primary care, who now looking back probably said the thing that changed my life the most, went to her first and she was like, I don't know what to do with you. So I'm going to send you to somebody who I think will know. And because she admitted she didn't know what to do with me, I started seeing specialists. In about 2-3 months, I had, I think, 8 to 10 specialists. I was going up to LA to get care. All my symptoms continued to worsen. That resulted in a 3-year medical leave of absence in the middle of my college experience. Transferred schools to be near my care in Los Angeles, and finished out my college career much later than I had anticipated, but finished it and graduated last year. And throughout all of that, really was lonely and wanted to make friends who are going through something similar to what I was going through, my age. So I started to get creative with ways to meet those people. And one of those big ways was writing, putting my story out there first and then hoping people would respond to it. So that's the spark notes. Now I'm here with you.
And what was your blog called, or what is it called? Didn't you have a blog?
Okay. Yeah, I wrote a opinion column at my school's newspaper called Chronically Catherine. And
that's right.
It was the first anything at the student newspaper that shared first person perspective of a student living on campus with disability and chronic illness. And the response was overwhelming. And really beautiful. So it led me to patient advocacy and wanting to get involved in research. And I ended up meeting a lot of really cool young people who are already doing that. And I was so new and so fresh. And I really hadn't considered people living with disabilities until I became disabled. I think that's the truth for a lot of people who aren't born with a disability.
Absolutely. You know, and I have so many parallels to you. Sorry, I'm not making this about me, but I got diagnosed right after I did my study abroad in my junior year of college in Australia. But I was lucky enough to be able to finish it, and because it was still I had a mystery illness, but it was not as debilitating is what it sounds like you were going through. It was more like, I could still use that kind of athlete mindset of like, I know something's wrong, I'm just going to push through it. You know,
yeah.
I went to various doctors, got different scans, got different tests. No one knew, but yeah, it's like, life interrupted, you know, like you have this plan for your life. And if you're an achieving person who's used to saying, I'm making a goal, I'm going to achieve this. I'm, you know, it's very, so disorienting to, you know, as a young person be told, well, you have this problem that we actually don't know how to solve.
Yeah.
You're like, what? So I have like 9,000 questions.
Wonderful.
But as I said, the difference between you and I is that I got a very definitive, like they were like, all of your RA related blood tests are like off of the charts. Like the charts don't go high enough. Like you have moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis. Like you need to get on this medicine. And then I was very lucky that the medicine put me into remission for 6 years. So I was able to kind of have this was my hero's journey, right? I figured out, I had a problem, figured out it was RA, took the medicine, it felt better. And I thought that was what I was going to do the next like 70 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And then I had to contend with, oh, this is actually more complicated 6 years later. But in your case, it was like, it went from like complicated without any sort of framework of what it is to, it's still complicated, but we know it's maybe something autoimmune sounding.
Yes. Yeah, that's accurate. It is autoimmune in nature. It's rheumatologic in nature. It's immunologic. I do have a diagnosed immune deficiency, which is a subclass immune deficiency. So it was a little sneaky to figure out because it was a special test for this one IgG subclass that isn't tested on. That's how it was explained to me. I definitely have POTS. I definitely have some sort of EDS-MCAS interaction. Definitely have chronic migraine. But all of these are sort of, I think the chicken before the egg was this autoimmune condition, and it's now gone untreated. I don't have, you know, I don't have an immune modulating treatment like most people with autoimmune conditions get once they have a diagnosis. For me, it's really been just plugging holes on a leaky boat. You know, sticking band-aids on, you know, a war wound. It's like just trying to like hold things together so I can have some semblance of a quality of life without really knowing which biologic, let's say, for example, to invest my time and body into. It was really just like, let's get her over the finish line of college, then we'll see how she's doing and if we want to move forward with some sort of immune modulating treatment. So it's really just been symptom management. I don't even know. I've probably gone through over 100 medications at this point. And I'm on a regimen that allows me to work remotely, to do things that bring me happiness, but it's really every day. When is the shoe going to drop? If we make it to the end of the day and the shoe didn't drop, that's a major win. Usually at some point in the day, I have to pause my life and address what my body needs. And I thought I was like so special and unique, you know, being like, oh, they don't really know what I have. Like, you know, I'm not like other girls. Wrong. Most people don't have a diagnosis for a long time or don't have a clear diagnosis or get misdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the people who do have a diagnosis, well, I mean, not unfortunate for them, like,
yeah,
awesome for them, but getting a diagnosis quickly is really not common.
No.
That's been, the more I talk to young people, the more it's like, well, their diagnosis is delayed because, oh, you're too young to be that sick.
That's what I was told.
Be in that much pain.
Mm-hmm.
Other kids your age don't complain about this. And then there's like the sexism when you're a young adult, especially. I think I luckily fell into the hands of people who are like, great, yes, we don't know what this is, but we're going to help you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people fall into the hands of, we don't know what this is, see you later.
That's what mine was. Actually, not just see you later, but go to psych. It must be psych.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if there's anyone who would have their body be ravaged by an unknown diagnosis with lots of diffuse symptoms across their body that wouldn't feel a little anxious about that. You know, I'm like, yeah. Is it actually like, why? Like, anyway, that's a whole other issue of, I definitely fell into the category of, we don't know what's wrong with you. You must be just crazy, quote unquote.
Yeah.
You go to psych, and it's so frustrating. And, it's so funny because, I'm 42 now, and I'm like, yeah, us young people with arthritis. And I'm like, wait a minute, because now I'm a mom to like a 10, an almost 10-year-old. And I know I'm not young anymore, but it's weird because the word arthritis for most people conjures an idea of an elderly person. I'm like still young, quote unquote, for arthritis, but I'm not a young adult anymore. Like I'm not a 20, in my 20s, like you are. So, I really like what you said. And I remember it from when I got diagnosed when I was 21, by the way, just for the record of anyone listening. So similar age to you. And at the time of your diagnosis, if I did the math right. How old were you?
I was 21.
We're 21. Yeah.
2018. I'm 25 now.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Same age. And you said, you never really thought about disability and young people one way or another. Right.
I hadn't, except that like one kid in high school who has cancer and everyone does Relay for Life for him one time. And then we all kind of like forget about it. There's always that one kid where we're like, oh yeah, like, oh, life is so short, oh, don't take things for granted. And then everyone just kind of like gets on with their high school, whatever shenanigans. And aside from that, I didn't know people in my high school. People did not talk about when I was in high school, which was like 2012 to 2016-ish. Mm-hmm. We were not talking about gender, race, disability, neurodivergency, queerness, we weren't talking about what it's like to be an immigrant. We weren't talking what it's like to live in an immigrant household. We weren't talking about socioeconomic status. I mean, truly, when I graduated high school in 2016 is when we were that sort of those terms started slipped into the norm. We're slipping into the norm. And it wasn't really until Trump was elected when I was in college that all of a sudden that was a part of common discourse in the college classroom, those terms, these concepts. So I think I kind of missed the boat in high school for discussions or safe spaces where differences were like celebrated or acknowledged in the first place. So when I became disabled, I was like, I literally didn't know anybody else in my life who had ever had a chronic illness, not RA, not Crohn's, not even somebody with like a T1
diabetes.
Nobody.
Wow.
So it was super confusing to me to like look in the mirror, see my same body if I didn't have an IV or a PIC or a port accessed. And I looked exactly the same. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not allowed to call myself disabled. Like I'm not missing a leg. I don't use a cane. I didn't even have a handicap parking pass at the time, which, oh my God, can I tell you, that is the best thing in the world is having a handicap parking pass.
Yeah.
I have one now. It saves my life. But it was super confusing being a young adult, not looking disabled. I didn't know I was allowed to call myself disabled. That was a term for like people who really were really sick it was confusing. It was so confusing.
I appreciate your, like, this is a very vivid description of like invisible illness. And I think, we are often aware of acute injuries or acute illnesses like cancer used to be. Now kind of cancer is considered a little more of a chronic illness for most cancers if caught early. But let's just say, you either overcome your battle, you break your leg and you get better, or you have cancer and you overcome it, or there you don't have a framework from a young age, even as like a child, for some people get sick and never get all the way better, but they also don't die. Like they just exist in the world. And I've actually had this book idea for a few years called like the owie that didn't get better.
I love it. I would buy it.
I know. And it's like, I just think we need like, and even my son, like he's, you know, over the years, it's been fascinating to see it through the eyes of a child of trying to, you know, I've always been really honest with him. Like, you know, like, and I want him to know from a young age, like some owies don't get better, but that doesn't mean that all owies don't get better, but it also doesn't, you know, it's just, it's, we have to learn how to cope with the discomfort or the uncertainty and discomfort. And I'm curious about the friends, you know, your friend group or your superior group, like how did a lot, oftentimes with younger people in their 20s or late teens who get diagnosed, it's very, it can be very isolating because it's hard enough for you to wrap your mind around it. Now you're asking your friends to wrap your mind around it. You're like, I can't even wrap my mind around it, but I'd like you to try to wrap your mind around it because.
I think if I could go back and give myself some advice when I first got diagnosed at 21, it would be not everybody is going to weather the storm, and that's okay. And I had friends who, for whatever reason in my life, in their life, we couldn't weather the storm of what was going on with my health together. And I don't blame them, and I don't blame myself for the fact that our friendship didn't work out or it didn't stand the test of time, because I had no idea what was happening to me. They certainly weren't going to have a better understanding than I did.
Yeah.
And what was happening to me was scary. I was in and out of the hospital. COVID hit. Everyone was isolating. I'd already kind of been living like that for 2 years. So when COVID hit, my family was like, welcome to our world.
Yeah.
But I was actually in and out of the hospital for not COVID related things 3 times in 2020. And it was scary for my family, for my friends. The friends who did weather the storm, my advice to that, like to myself and to other people who are trying to support somebody with chronic illness and haven't necessarily experienced it for themselves, is to set boundaries and to do your own research. Don't expect somebody with chronic illness to teach you everything about the way they live their life, because sometimes they won't have the energy to, but also the greatest form of love and appreciation and understanding is if you like Google it yourself and ask them questions. And then with the setting boundaries thing, it's okay to say to a friend with chronic illness, I don't have space to support you right now. Do you have somebody else you can reach out to? Or I love you so much. It sounds like you need somebody who can be really present for you right now. I can't be that person in this moment. Could you call your mom? Or is someone else available? And those relationships, those friendships, even in romantic relationships, that gives me, it builds a lot of trust, because not everybody at every time of the day is going to be able to drop everything and listen to you vent or feel secure enough to hear about really hard things like being in chronic pain or having a high pain day or feeling incredibly distressed by like the existential early mortality of, you know, like of you, or, you know, like these are really heavy subjects. And so even my family too, there are ways that I cope with it in therapy, poetry, songwriting, writing my column. And then I have different people that I go to in my now strong network for different things. And I wish that my younger self had somebody just tell her that.
I think of it from the lens of like social scripts. And again, I'm going back to pediatrics. My first career as an OT was in pediatrics, with children with actually developmental disabilities. So I was always very aware from a young age, because I had some family members with developmental disabilities. So I was very, very aware of, like, you know, cerebral palsy and, you know, autism spectrum and just global developmental delay or intellectual disabilities. I was not aware of chronic illness at all. But, you know, that we learn through social scripts, you know, that we are taught at a young age, and we don't have a script for, you know, being there for somebody who's in pain when there's not, everyone wants to get well soon. Mm-hmm. You're like, but I'm actually not going to get well soon because I'm chronically ill, and chronically means forever. But I know what you mean. You're saying it as like a shorthand for, I hope that you shortly are not going to be in as much pain as you are currently. But yeah. You know, it's hard. And I think you're so right that we can't expect everyone in our life to be what we need at every moment. And maybe about maybe getting a little eclectic collection of different people. I don't know if you found this, but I had a couple friends who actually were more there for me when I was doing poorly. They're actually like, that was their superpower, was like they,
yeah.
And then, but when I was doing well, like they were either like maybe a little jealous or a little like just uncomfortable for whatever reason. And it's like some people, you know, will actually be better at being there for you when you need help, which surprised me.
Yes, that is true. I wish I could tell my younger self, like, just wait who comes out of the woodwork. You know, yes. I had my graduation party this for university this past May of 2023. I invited everybody who had ever had a hand in helping me cross the finish line with school, whether it was a physical therapist who came to my house during COVID. And then when I went to school, I didn't see him for many years, but he had a hand in getting me back on my feet well enough to be independent enough to go back to school. You know, I invited my doctors. I invited a doctor who took care of me one time in a hospital, but changed my life. I invited pharmacy staff from my local pharmacy who took care of me, anybody and everybody. And even if they didn't come, just a way to say, you know, let me give you some cupcakes and some food and a hug.
Yeah.
And it was like the coolest. It was like the most epic, intense, like Avengers collision of worlds, because all of these people showed up who did not know each other at all. Only a few of them had met before. And I just got to walk around my house and hear about the way these people were connecting was over me. And at what point had they met me and how did they help me? And then they would turn to somebody else and be like, oh, how do you know Catherine? Or, you know, like, at what point were you involved in her life? And I just sat there and was like, wow, I really have a village. And it was very special to see all of them in one place.
Yeah.
Because over like 6 years, I had met all these different people all over Southern California. And now they were all in one place meeting each other. It was so cool. It was so cool. Yeah. I was like having an out of body experience, but it really does take a village. And that building that village took time. It took years. But if you had told me it's going to take years to like, you know, figure out how I'm going to be independent, I would be like, I'll give up now. You know, all right, might as well turn in, give up. So I think it's all about just doing the next right thing for you, and then you can turn around and look at this like wake of right things you decided to do for yourself with the information you had at the time, and suddenly you have, you're like little Pied Piper, and you have all these people who have followed you in your wake and helped you get to where you are today.
That is such a fabulous idea. I want to do that now, like have a party where I just invite everyone who's helped me over the years, because, you know, yeah, you're right. It's like it's such an eclectic experience. Like you're going to this facility for this, you're going to this person for that. And
yeah.
And it's such a massive labor of executive functioning to manage it all. And you never get this kind of moment of cohesion unless you're in like a multidisciplinary center, you know, that's kind of a very rare experience. So I love that. I feel like this should be a normal thing. We should do this. Like, I mean, I know you maybe can't do it like every.
If you have ever felt completely lost or utterly alone while trying to navigate real life with rheumatic disease, listen up. I am here for you. I created an educational program to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. And it's called Room to Thrive. After earning a master's in occupational therapy and completing hundreds of hours of additional training, I created a step-by-step guide to help you truly thrive with rheumatic disease. This is the only program I know of that's designed to improve quality of life for people living with inflammatory, autoimmune forms of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, Sjogren's disease, and more. During the self-paced lessons, you'll learn how to manage pain and fatigue, cope with stress, navigate relationships, and continue doing the things that matter to you and bring you joy. The goal is really to help you improve your quality of life and learn how to thrive with your rheumatic disease right now, rather than waiting for a distant day when it might be cured or healed. I really created the down-to-earth, practical, heartfelt resource I wish I had had when I was first diagnosed at age 20. If you want even more in-depth support, you can join the 12-week Room to Thrive virtual support group, where you'll be surrounded by people who actually get what you're going through, people who will provide the encouragement, validation, and support that you deserve. Each group is expertly moderated, so you don't have to worry about the kind of misinformation that spreads like wildfire in the free-for-all social media groups. If you're on the fence, don't just take my word for it. Here's what Katie had to say in March 2023. I was lost and overwhelmed with my RA diagnosis. It felt overwhelming to know what to read, what to do, how to spend my energy trying to research on the internet. Room to Thrive did that for me. It's been like getting a crash course in my diagnosis along with a community who gets it. To see all the details, including the dates for the next support groups, go to the link in the show notes or bit.ly/thriveroom with a capital T and capital R. You can also just email me anytime at info@myarthritislife.net. And don't delay if you're interested, because each group is capped at 16 people or less in order to make a small, intimate group atmosphere. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to get started with the next groups. And I can't wait for those of you who are interested in the self-paced option to go ahead and join that at any time. Bye-bye for now. Single year, but oh, I also meant to ask, I'm sorry, I just didn't remember to ask this earlier. What did you study? What did you get your degree in?
Oh, so I started as a poli-sci theater double major at the first school that I went to. And then I transferred to a school closer to my care in Los Angeles. And then I did this major. It's an interdisciplinary major called Law, History, and Culture. And you can take classes in anything law, history, and culture. And when I went back to school, I really knew I wanted to do patient advocacy, disability advocacy work. Mm-hmm. And so I chose this major so that I could tailor it to doing, you know, all classes related to patient advocacy, healthcare, narrative medicine, disability law, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then I was also a theater minor, because like I'm a theater girl at heart and I'll never let go of it.
That's awesome.
So that's what I majored. You know, there's no patient advocacy major undergrad. UCLA just announced a disability studies major undergrad. I think it's one of maybe three in the country. There's 3 to 5 undergrad programs where you can major in disability studies in the US. There are some in Canada, but even grad programs in the US, there's very few in Canada. I went to USC, but plug for UCLA for having a disability studies major undergrad.
I went to a liberal arts undergrad, so there was definitely not that disability wasn't addressed at times. Like I took a medical anthropology class and that was really fascinating.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was so cool. Medical anthropology is so fascinating. We didn't have, and there was no like actually practical majors. I mean, I just majored in psychology, but you know. But and then are you in academia now?
Technically, yes. So okay. I'm on a PCORI-funded project run through University of Wisconsin River Falls. Mm-hmm. And one of our project leads is faculty there. And the PCORI-funded project is called the Young Patients Autoimmune Research and Empowerment Alliance, mm-hmm. or YP Area for short. And we are like a council of young people all across the US. were 15 with three project leads who are basically professional young patients with autoimmune conditions who are trained to work with researchers. So we have this abundance of research about young people with autoimmune conditions that doesn't actually involve young patients in the research process.
Yeah.
And that
why would we want
is...
to include the people that this is about? What could that possibly help? I'm this sarcasm font. Yeah.
So I actually did not join the group with any formal scientific research experience.
I see.
That's the point. The point is that anybody can join, learn how to tell their story, do some basic scientific dissemination, research process training, and go forth and be an advocate in research spaces. And have trusted advisors and adults who are researchers also themselves to ask questions about the process, make sure they're not being taken advantage of, you know, be able to recommend things in language that researchers will understand, like work together with researchers and make it as a cohesive and efficient process as possible. But the young people I work with, I joined because it was posted on Savvy Cooperative.
Oh yeah. I interviewed Jen for this podcast. She's amazing.
Yes.
Jeff. Yeah.
So my mom sent it to me and was like, someone's forming a council and this sounds like you should be on it. And I was like, heck yeah, young people, like sign me up. Mm-hmm. I want to make friends. I was like, I don't really care what I'm doing. I just want to make young friends with chronic illness. And it was during COVID. So it was going to be all virtual. And I was like, great, that's accessible. Joined it and was like, wait a second, I really like research. And I had already been reading a ton of it for my conditions, because I'm like, the more information I can get my hands on, the better. Like, all of those, like, stalking cute boys, stalking, you know, potential dates, or like, you know, sleuthing for a friend. All of those skills came in handy when I was doing research, like looking at research and reading it and being really discerning with the information that was honestly, like, what's the word? Information that was having a trickle down effect to the medicines and treatments available to people my age, to people with my conditions, that were affecting legislative decisions. And I was like, whoa, 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 this research thing, this is kind of important. is kind of, we got to get in on this, because it's the farther up the ladder you go in terms of power, especially in the US, people are using research to make real sweeping decisions. And you can kind of cherry pick research that supports an agenda. Yeah. And so how can we get young people involved in the very, like, fundamental, most bottom layer of how policy and legislation is often decided, which is the data that these legislators are making decisions based off of research.
So we're talking about scientific research.
Yeah, scientific research, qualitative and quantitative. And for our listeners, qualitative is usually it's something to do with, like, the quality of the experience of something or someone. Right. It can be numbers driven, but it's not necessarily hard data. Quantitative, quantity, think numbers.
Like,
you can probably explain that better.
Typically, qualitative data is derived from, like, interviews or, you know, patient reporting.
Yes.
Like, this is what I felt like. And you're right that you can put a number on it, like, rate on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain you were in before or after X intervention. But the real, in the real quantitative research tends to get a little bit more, you know, visibility in policy and stuff like that, because it's, you can't just argue that, well, that's just someone's perception. Like, pain, saying I'm rating my scale on a pain, saying I'm rating my scale, my pain on a scale of 1 to 10 is still subjective, even though you can put a number on it, versus my blood markers are X. Like, you can't be like, she just thought they were X. Like, no, they were X, you know, they were 17 or 240, you know? And PCORI stands for Patient Centered Outcomes and Research Institute.
And so I'm going to put a link to them in the chat too. And not the chat. What am I talking about? In the show notes, in the chat. Like, this is alive. No, it's not. And I just think it's something that I never thought when I was not plugged into anything. There was no, when I got diagnosed in 2003, there wasn't any social media, you know, there was, yeah, it's all totally different back then. So it right now it's great that people through the power of the internet can learn about mm-hmm. these opportunities. And was your first, so was your involvement with PCORI the first time you got involved? That was the first time you got involved with research, right?
It was the first time I was involved in formal research, you know, with an IRB that was, had a huge source of funding from an mm-hmm. institute. Mm-hmm. And quick plug for YP Area, we are recruiting right now.
Oh,
so
perfect.
If you are 16 to 23 with an autoimmune condition of any kind, it's at YP_area on Instagram. You can also go to our website. Please come join, apply. And so quick plug for that. But to answer your question, my first formal research experience was actually in undergrad. I was in a class called The History of Discrimination at the University. Wow. And it was a class where you were meant to directly examine how the university has participated in discrimination against any group in the history of the university. So some people chose racism, some people chose homophobia. Me and my partner were like, well, what about disability discrimination? And we very quickly found out that, much like doing the hard history projects with that are pretty popular now with universities examining their historical relationship with slavery, nobody has done a hard history project on disability discrimination. And we were looking for other similar projects at universities and couldn't find one. So we decided to do our own. And it was like a treasure hunt, finding these old, old articles, these old pictures, these old testimonies. We were like digging through the archives at the university. And that's when I like got the bug for research. And I felt like I always wanted to be a spy growing up, because I was like, acting and political science, spy.
You are and a spy. I
felt like a spy, and I love the tea. I love the gossip. And yeah. So, we definitely were getting our fix from doing this research. And that was my first experience into research. And it was by accident. It was like truly by accident. I used to think people who did research who were young, I was like, oh, you're so cool. Like, you're like, whatever, 16-year-olds who are like, yeah, I do research. And I'm like, how do you even get into that? What does that even mean?
Yeah.
That's like, I don't even understand how that works. It can literally be as simple as something as like taking a class and then being like, oh, I kind of want to just like continue this paper that I'm writing, or continue this subject that I'm finding really interesting. And bam, you're doing research. That's it.
And you know, I think if we zoom out a little bit to like the history of, not to nerd out, but hey, it's my podcast.
I love history.
The history of like scientific research, and this history, it kind of mimics the history of the patient doctor relationship, where it used to be, mm-hmm. you know, let's say, you know, I remember my mom was telling me about when she was, you know, just some of the horrible things that her doctor said to her when she was, you know, in labor with me. Anyway, but you know, how the doctor used to be the voice of God. You as the patient had no power, no say. It was like the doctor said, you do this, you do that, don't do, you know. And now there's been a transformation where patients are ideally, not actually in practice, but the best practice is for patients to be equal, you know, partners in managing their mm-hmm. care, particularly for chronic conditions. And then that's the same with research, scientific research. Let's say a researcher is looking at rheumatoid arthritis. In the olden days, it used to be, well, we just get a bunch of people with PhDs together, and then the only role of the patient is to come into the research lab and, you know, either answer a questionnaire or participate in an intervention, like
let's say for my world as an occupational therapist, it could be an intervention where you are, you know, given an exercise program, just something really simple. Like you do exercise for 30 minutes, 5 days a week with the people in the study and, or, you know, with the researchers. And then you have no say in anything else about, you don't, as a patient, you don't get to contribute to the research design. You don't get to give any feedback. You're just kind of a rat in the scientific study. Nowadays there's such a movement, and I don't even know what the right word for it is, other than just patient partners in care. Patients are seen as partners in the development at all stages of scientific,
yes,
you know, research studies. So they would say, I remember Jen Horajeff, who I'm going to put her, I always pronounce her last name wrong, but I'm going to put a link to her podcast episode. But she said, you know, she was on like an FDA, like she's high. She's a really amazing patient, you know, advocate. And she was on some sort of, you know, FDA panel. And she was like, well, why aren't you guys asking about fatigue? Like, this is like, my pain is one thing, but my fatigue is really bad. This is episode 20 of the Arthritis Life podcast. And they're like, oh, we didn't think about asking about fatigue. Like, that is why you need patient partners, right?
Yeah.
To tell you what's actually important to patients. Mm-hmm. So with YP area, is it right to say, I'm looking at the website right now, just so I'm not saying anything wrong, but that you help patient young people become involved in research studies?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we're kind of like a clearinghouse. We have requests coming in from researchers all the time. Like, we want to do good. We want to do right by young patients. Do you have people you can give us with X? Like, basically we're kind of matchmakers sometimes with researchers who want to involve young people. The flip side is we also do education for young patients. So we will put together materials for a young patient who's getting involved in research for the first time. And we've created some of our own materials. We'll also give materials to providers and community partners who have young patients who are asking them questions and they want to pass along our information. But we have like a few different functions, and one of them is also authoring our own research and doing research by us for us. And the ethos and what makes our group different from other organizations is that every decision made by the group is democratically done by all young patients and all members of the group. And the social community aspect of things is huge. We meet monthly, we have weekly meetings with different committees. And it's completely a group run by 16 to 23 year olds, and we get stuff done. Like, it's
amazing.
These are motivated people. And I think young people often get the reputation for being lazy or not proactive, or I don't know, just being labeled as selfish or self-interested. And I'm like, no, we just know too much nowadays. We have too much information at our fingertips to feel like we're overwhelmed by like the death of the planet, by gun violence,
just
by
little things
scared going to school, people who are making decisions about our bodies. And like, yeah, no wonder we're a little pissed and angsty, because we have to clean up a big mess, a very big mess. And so there's a lot of really good, feisty, passionate energy on the council. And we really all help each other channel it towards working within systems that already exist and can do good, and helping refine those systems.
That's amazing. I think the young people, I feel so old saying this, but the young generation currently is just like so much more, you know, they're just so much more in, how would I put it? Like, understanding of systems. Like, I had no idea what systems were at play, like systems of oppression and like things like that. I was just really naive when I was your age. So I think I'm just really inspired by the work that you're doing. And
I definitely think the young voices need to be heard, you know, in research. And I think I often do encourage people, you know, who are feeling in a state, what regardless of their age, if people are feeling really frustrated and disempowered with like the healthcare systems and stuff, you know, becoming involved either in research or within like legislative advocacy mm-hmm. is so helpful. But if you have the mental energy, the cognitive and emotional energy, to do it, and you don't have to do it all on your own. You can go through the Arthritis Foundation or Creaky Joints or other, you know, autoimmune association. They'll help hook you up with your local legislator, and you can say, look, this is what step therapy did to me. This is how I have suffered as a result of these inhumane systems. And this is why we need, you know, healthcare reform. It's like, it gives you something positive that you can do to hopefully mm-hmm. change, right?
Yeah. I think my best tip to people who want to like get their feet wet is if you're on social media. It took me a while to learn how to do this, to make Instagram, for example, like a place that wasn't triggering, honestly. And so I have an Instagram for my column. It's called, my handle is It's Chronically Catherine, spelled with a C. I made it such that the people I follow, if you just scroll who I follow and you follow on these people, these are good people who are doing good work and are great educators. Go give them a follow, go see what they're about and see if some of it resonates with you. It made me feel a lot less alone, especially during the pandemic. But there are other young groups like Generation Patient, which is a fantastic group doing a lot of legislative and policy activism work on behalf of young patients. They're a fantastic group to follow. Also like YouTubers, just seeing people live their daily life with disability and whatever, still be into fashion or still be into sports. And, mm-hmm. You know, it was super cool. You can also do things like apply for fellowships. The Coelho Center for Disability Law Policy and Innovation at LMU in Los Angeles, they have a disability law fellowship. It's a year long. It's fully remote. There are things you can do, formal and informal, just to get your toes wet. So there's a lot of ways to get involved. And each way can be tailored to what's most accessible for you. And that's what's kind of cool once you realize you're part of the disability community, it's like, ah, we're so here to welcome you with open arms. Like, yeah, it's like, nah, get over here. Yeah, you're one of us. Yeah. So that was kind of the best part about coming to terms with my identity as a disabled woman is, you know, the term is an accurate descriptor, but it drops you into the world of people who get it. And when somebody hears that word and also identifies as being disabled, it's like you guys are speaking a secret language.
Completely. And I think
I found this on the web.
Oh, I found this on the web. Sorry.
Siri.
Our devices are listening to us. Before we go to the rapid fire questions, I didn't prepare you for this question, but I think you're going to be just fine. But you know, when I grew up, and actually even into when I was teaching at an occupational therapy assistant program, mm-hmm. and the textbook, this was in 2016, said always use person first language when talking about disabilities. It's person with disability, person with autism, person with, you never, because that's in, it's inhumanizing to say disabled. We don't want to say that, or autistic. And I'm saying this to frame the question to you, which I know kind of the answer, but for the audience, can you explain why you identify as disabled and why someone might choose that over person first, quote unquote, language?
Yeah. So I have an A side and B side response to this. For those of us who had cassettes growing up or record players, the A side is words matter and languaging matters. Being cognizant of how words have impact is super important. My mom, when I started identifying with the word disabled, it was literally just like 1 week I just started saying it and I didn't quite realize that I did. And at the end of the week, she was like, so I noticed that you're using this word disability and disabled. Can I ask you about it? And I kind of told her, oh yeah, like, I don't know, I just, it just makes sense. It just feels like it makes sense for me. And I ended up writing a column on sort of that journey. But she also then asked, well, you know, help educate me. You know, I thought it was supposed to be a person with disability. And I validated that and was like, thank you for asking. And thank you for thinking about that and being proactive about your language and your words, because that really does matter. The B side is, I don't think that much about how I language the word disability anymore, because it's such a common part of my vernacular now. I think in specific instances, it can make a big difference, and it can describe someone's lived experience in a way that may be truest to them. For me personally, I'm like, if I'm using the word disability or disabled, if I'm talking with you, even when I'm talking with friends who don't have a disability, I don't even notice that. I don't frankly care in those instances. Some instances I do, you know, if I'm speaking or if, especially if I'm writing. So I think it's important to be mindful of that languaging. And then there may be specific instances where that really does matter that you use person first language. But in my everyday, I really don't care. It doesn't bother me a whole lot. And I also think there's nothing wrong with having a preference and expressing that.
Yeah, I appreciate the nuance in your answer. And it's definitely, it's not a unified preference. There's not a unified preference that everyone prefers to be. Yeah. And I think that the assumption, what I was taught in school, and I actually had to, I pushed back to my supervisor when I was teaching at the OT assistant program. I said, this is not, I'm not going to teach them that they have to use person first, because some of our patient communities do not like that. Like, and especially like, if I don't know if you're aware of like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, but they have, they're saying in general, the preferred term that they're recommending is autistic versus person with autism, because the person first language, when it comes to something that affects your identity and the way you view the world so deeply, like, let's just say autism, it is, there's the presumption of person with is to say, well, you're a person first, and then you have this terrible thing. Like, you're a person with cancer, you're a person with, you know, rheumatoid arthritis. Oh yeah. If I could choose to not have rheumatoid arthritis, I would choose not to, right? I don't like it. It doesn't, I'm going to live my best life with it, but I'd prefer not to have it. Whereas like a person with autism, well, wait a minute. You're saying like, you're still a person. You're just a person with this problem we got to figure out, you know? So I think that a lot of people, they call it identity first language to say, you know, autistic, or in the case of, let's talk about, you know, disability and disabled. Oh, you're not disabled. You're just differently abled. Or like they're say like, you're not, they're saying, I'm going to be nice to you by saying you're a person with a disability, because in this almost like this way where it makes it seem like they're there, it's okay, you're still a person. I was like, of course I'm still a person, you know? So
that's- Yeah, I like your thoughts on that. I hadn't heard it sort of described in that way. And I think that's more why I don't, you know, if somebody likes person first language, sweet. Yeah. Sounds good to me, you know? It's not, it's like the whole pronouns thing. Like if you have a specific way you like to be referred to, easy peasy lemon squeezy. Sounds good to me. You know, it's it's not a big deal. Because like at the end of the day, words really matter. And so yeah, I think it doesn't bother me if it's person first language, but I like how you're making me think about identity first language as something, it's just matter of fact, just the way it is. It's, you know, I'm not somebody with something. I'm not like Catherine with, like, it's a part of my many, many, many other identities that I have.
Yeah.
But it is an incredibly immediate signifier of my lived experience. Yeah. And that's really valuable in some situations. There are times where I've had to, somebody has said something to me or a doctor is treating me a certain way. And I'm like, as a disabled person, that's really wrong to say. Or, yes. You know, like as a disabled woman, I get treated like that a lot. And the way you're speaking to me now is inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And, or if I've been on some dates recently where people have just said the most out of pocket things about disability.
Oh no.
And no, like just, it's funny. As this like funny stories. And they don't know I'm disabled. And then I disclose. Oh. Yeah. And then I disclose and they're like, oh, I had no idea. So like, it's an important word. Disability is an important, important word. And so yeah, it has a time and place and a purpose and differently abled. I wrote a column on this if you want to include
it. I was
going
to say, I literally pulled it up because you said you wrote one that disability is not a bad word. So I'm putting this in the show notes because she's not going to brag about herself. So I will. Catherine is an amazing writer. I love it. Right here, you say the word disability was a word that gave me the same feeling as hearing the word beefy, uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's how I used to feel. So, it takes time. Everybody comes to it on their own terms or doesn't come to it. I have friends who are like, I don't really like the word disability. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
It's kind of like the process. It reminds me of the process of like dismantling your own internalized ableism, right? It's like this, like I've pointed that out to a rheumatologist before. I was once interviewed in a podcast and their person was like, well, you know, like we like to tell patients now, like you can have a totally normal life with rheumatoid arthritis. And I was like, yeah, that word is like kind of funny to me, say a normal life, or I have a kind of funny relationship with that because it sounds like what you mean is that a normal life is a life where disability is not part of it. You don't have to worry about it because you just take your medicine and then you're totally quote unquote normal. Yeah. And, or, you know, and I would, when I was pregnant, as long as it's healthy, as long as everyone said that, as long as it's healthy, I'm sure you're just, you know, blah, blah, blah. As long as it's healthy, everything's, it's like, well, what if it's not? Like, not everyone's healthy. I'm not healthy, by the way. I know I look like a cute little pregnant lady, but I'm not, you know? And so.
Yeah, you're like, what about me? Yeah. What about, I'm not
also,
healthy.
Yeah, also, yeah, there's that. But, you know, the process of saying, like, there is not only one way to live, like, a beautiful life, you know? Yeah. And if we say that the only goal of our life, and this is kind of what all my conversations end up being about on the podcast, kind of coming back to like acceptance and being tolerant of uncertainty. It's like what that which you hold holds you. If you hold this idea that the only way to be a vibrant young person is to conquer your chronic illness and find the solutions to your health issues, and that's the goal of life, you're kind of held. That's holding that holds you. That means that you're not going to be happy unless you achieve that, where there's a different way, like that you've built as a testament to your life, as you're figuring it out. Like, hey, I'm a vivacious, cool, young, hip. Sorry, I'm so 42 right now.
I love it.
I'm like, you're cool. We're cool, right? Like the mom and Mean Girls. Like, hey guys.
That's so true. I have a quick anecdote and then we can get to the rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
Which is I don't know, a couple years in my diagnosis journey had this like complete revelation. I was just like in the shower, you know, minding my own business. And then I was like, wait, it was like some plans that I had canceled for the night because I was not feeling well. It's like, I could either sit at home and not feel well or go out and still not feel well. Either way, I'm going to wake up feeling like shit tomorrow morning. So I think I'm just going to go out and feel sick, but still have a fun time.
Yeah.
That changed my world. I'm like, do it scared, do it sick, show up with a migraine. You know, obviously if it's going to really harm you, don't, but I have gotten to know my body so well that I'm like, yeah, my head's going to hurt about the same if I'm going to be at home versus if I'm going to go out with my friends. So I'd rather feel fulfillment from, you know, by being with my friends, even if I have to cut it short, even if I only be there for 30 minutes, even if my parents have to drive me and I'm 23, you know, like that's a thing. But I've just decided to do it sick anyways. And I have really grown my like I've totally become a social butterfly as a result. Mm-hmm. And I did it scared at first, and now I am like really skilled at knowing my body well enough to decide, oh yeah, I could kind of just go do this sick anyways. And I think that's part of the acceptance and part of the making a beautiful life despite the infiniteness of chronic illness.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I'm so glad we're recording this. So glad.
Yay. All right, rapid fire.
Okay, rapid fire, which you know me well enough now that I'm not capable of actually keeping anything rapid fire, but we'll try. Aspirational goals. Okay, so best words of wisdom for newly diagnosed patients.
Ooh, this is so hard.
I know. Do it scared. Do it sick. I like what you just said. It was great.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that or take time off.
Mm.
Take a month off. It's going to change your life.
Yeah,
step away from school. Yep. Take the time off. Nothing is more important than your health. If you can, obviously there are situations where, you know, that's just really impossible, mm-hmm. but if you can, just say no, take time off.
Yep. Don't wait till it gets worse to take time off. Take it now. Do you have a favorite arthritis or chronic pain gadget or tool in your toolbox?
Ooh, yes. It's called the box. And I made it during COVID because I would have to lie down because my neck would hurt so bad every 45 mm-hmm. minutes when things were flaring.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a cardboard box, one of the ones that my medicine came in. I laid in the box underneath it with the opening, obviously, like so that my shoulders could go into it. I'm lying mm-hmm. flat on the ground, cut out a hole in the top of the box, the size of my phone, placed my phone on it.
Oh.
And then I could watch a show while I was lying down icing or using the massager on my neck. And whenever I would get cranky, my family would be like, Catherine, go lie in your box. And I, patent pending, like I'm making this thing. I know they have it on Amazon.
Yeah.
But I mean, the box was free. It's probably $2 at Home Depot. Make yourself a box.
Accessibility 101. We need to do a video on this in all of your spare time. In my spare time, we should do a video showing this.
Yeah, we totally should. But yeah, that one's basically free. So make yourself a box.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love it. This is not what I was expecting. And that is amazing. What do you have a favorite book or movie or show you've been watching recently?
Oh my God. Community. 100%.
Classic.
Community. And then for a book, obviously anything Michelle Obama. I'm a huge comedian autobiography reader. Tig Notaro's book. Tig Notaro's a comedian.
Okay. Yeah, I listened to
Double Mastectomy.
Yeah. I've listened to her podcast. I haven't read her book yet.
Oh my God, read her book. Tig Notaro changed my life. Dark humor if you like that kind of stuff, but she went through it with mm-hmm. cancer and yeah, she's hilarious.
She's great. Did you hear her interview on the Conan O'Brien podcast? It's really hilarious.
Okay, I'll go listen to that.
No, she's so good. Okay. Do you have a favorite like mantra or inspirational saying?
Yes, it's actually right here on my computer. It's a little like picture of a dancing skeleton. It says, I may be chronically ill, but I'm also chronically fabulous.
I love it. I love that. Oh, that's so great. That's so great. And then two more. What's something that's been bringing you joy recently?
Doing things where I show up for myself without an audience. Like doing things where
No, just kidding.
Yeah. So like basically showing up for myself and doing things that make me happy with even when there's no audience, no one to say good job, no one to say, look at you go, no one to say, mm-hmm. that's awesome that you do that. And for me, that's been surfing. It's just been like, I'm just not going to tell anybody that I'm going and I'm just going to go do this for myself and show up for myself once or twice a week, get out in the water, do it. There's not an audience. No one knows I'm out here. No one's going to. And those things have been incredibly fulfilling.
That sounds amazing. I want to move to San Diego now.
Yeah. No, honestly, don't come here though. Like, because it's so expensive to live here now. And
Yeah, I went to the conference in November, still recovering my wallet from that. No,
dude,
yeah.
Honestly, truly. So maybe wait a little bit.
Okay, I'll wait a little bit. Okay. What, this is kind of a little bit redundant of things we've already talked about, but what does it mean to you to live a good life and thrive with chronic illness?
Be able to participate in the things that make me happy, even if it's in an accommodated way. Mm-hmm. So like with surfing, would love to go every day. Nope, can't handle that. I go once or twice a week. With exercising, you know, like used to love to do multi-day hikes, backpacking. Can't do that anymore. Instead, I do in and outs and I sleep somewhere comfortable, you know, make sure that I have access to medication. So, and not getting down on myself and thinking I'm weak or not as strong for doing it in an accommodated way.
That's huge. That's like, I'm going to give you like an honorary occupational therapy degree because that's like the whole purpose of our field is figuring out how to find that ways to accommodate and still find ways to participate. I love it. So thank you so much. I'm going to put your social media links and links to in the show notes, which are on the Arthritis Life podcast, arthritis.theenthusiasticlife.com. That's my full website. So I'll link to the YP area and Corey and
wonderful.
I'm so good at linking, not to brag. No, but but this is so great. I really appreciate you taking the time and hopefully we'll chat again someday, I'm sure. There's so many more things we could talk about.
Absolutely.
Yay. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for having me. Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Arthritis Life Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Room to Thrive, an educational program I created from scratch to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. You can go through the pre-recorded course on your own, or you can take the course along with a support group. Learn more at the link in my show notes, or you can always go to www.myarthritislife.net. And if you like this podcast, I would be so honored if you took the time to rate and review it. I also encourage you to share it with anyone you know who might benefit from it. I also wanted to remind you that you can find full transcripts, videos, and detailed show notes with hyperlinks for each episode on my website, www.myarthritislife.net. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or if you want to share your story or wisdom on the podcast, just shoot me an email at info@myarthritislife.net. I can't wait to hear from you.